Welcome to Long Story Long. I'm your host, Lisa Curry. Today's guest is the very talented rapper and comedy person, Open Mike Eagle. You may have seen his show, The New Negroes, on Comedy Central, or you may have heard his new album, Anime Trauma Divorce, which is very good. Check it out. How are you? How's everything going?
Man, it's so day to day. I have days where I feel like, wow, I have really managed to make something out of this mess, you know? And some days it's just like, the weight of everything is being felt intensely. And yeah, I'm doing a very corny dry January right now, but because I had to.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, it was, I have been doing a lot of drinking. And now that I'm not drinking, feeling all these damn feelings. Holy cow, it's too many feelings.
It's a lot. It's a lot. Anytime you're like, I don't like being left with my thoughts for too long.
Right. And that's like all I do now.
Yeah. That sounds like a tiny prison.
It's treacherous.
Are you still working on stuff quite a bit?
Yeah, I have to be. I'm running my podcast network. Mm-hmm. And, so just maintaining that. And then I'm taping the next season of like the flagship show on my network. So I'm getting that together. I just put the album out in October. So like I'm on like the tail end of promoting that.
And it's so good, by the way. I mean, I caught it late, but I love it.
Thank you. I mean, there's no such thing as time anymore. So it doesn't matter when. And yeah, you know, so like music stuff, podcast stuff and merch stuff has been like my whole life. And like, you know, trying to keep the people on my Patreon happy. And, you know, there's always something to do.
Yeah. What do you plan out? How far out do you plan albums or do you?
I have this kind of like inner feeling, like this inner sense of rhythm of like when I need to have a project out, you know, like,
so
the people don't forget it. So I can continue to exist.
You know? Yeah, I definitely get that.
So like, I kind of know when it's time. Like I haven't made anything really for myself in a while since after, you know, because once an album's done, I kind of have to like wait till it gets out to like go through the cycle again. It's kind of the way I operate. So like, I'm just now starting to formulate stuff for the next project, but it's way before like any sort of idea taking shape.
Yeah.
It's literally just like, oh, that could be interesting. That could be, but like, you know, who knows if this stuff even ends up on an album? Who knows if like, you know, it's just very, very vague until it hits me that it's time.
Yeah. What number album was this last one in October?
Depending on how you count, I think that was the sixth one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Cause some people don't count the ones I do with like one producer. Cause it's like me and somebody else.
Okay.
It's definitely, I think the fourth or fifth solo one. Yeah. Definitely.
Oh, that's awesome. What does the process get easier or do you feel like you get better in a linear way? You know, like some album to album?
In terms of like song crafting and recording, like being a recording artist, like those things, those are like the 10,000 hour things, you know what I'm saying?
So yeah,
they do get better kind of in a linear way. But every album's full of new ideas and every song is like the potential for like a really good idea in your mind that actually turns out to be a really good song or like something that sounded like a really good idea in your mind. And when you put it down, it's like, oh, this is not good at all. This is for no one. And that negotiation does not get any better from album to album. I don't get any better at knowing whether or not an idea is good before I actually do it.
Isn't that why I feel that way with jokes where sometimes I'm like, oh, everyone must think this. And then I'll tweet it out. And then, you know, an hour goes by and I have one fave and I'm like, oh, this is so embarrassing. Why?
But sometimes, you know, with those ideas, you're so funny like that. Cause sometimes I'll think like, oh man, like I'll instantly see it like that hour later, I'll look at it like, oh, I use like all the wrong words.
Like
I think this idea, this feeling, this sentiment is actually something, but I chose every wrong word.
There is something like where if you're off by a word, this is so dumb, but I tweeted something last night and I said like, I'm going to just based on like this stupid sketch artist on this murder documentary. I was like, oh, I'm going to be a police sketch artist for the LAPD. And then after I tweeted it, some people faved it. And then I was like, why did I say police and LAPD in the same sentence. Like, I shouldn't have
police routine.
It's just like one tiny word. I know that's such a dumb thing, but I'm like, oh, it would have been such a better joke if I didn't do that. And
I think that's super real. I think you do get very sensitive to stuff like word economy. And that's part of like what's cool about Twitter is that since you can't write too much,
yeah,
it does make you focus on like every word counting. And I think even that's how people read Twitter. You know, I think like when stuff is too long,
no,
kind of check out of it.
Mm-mm,
you know,
yeah.
Like the best ones are like really tight, you know?
Yeah. Like when people quoted tweet that's quote, it's like, I don't have time for this. Yeah. I do have time, but I'm not going to spend it here.
Yeah. Do you remember when there used to be that bit? Like somebody would start a tweet that was nothing and people would quote tweet it and keep like there was no there.
Where she just like, keeps going. I hate it. It makes me so mad because I'm like, I want to get to the center of it.
Yeah.
But I don't want to keep going through this. This is ridiculous.
I've done it a couple times and there's nothing there.
Yeah. Or when people argue that way, like when I want to watch a fight on Twitter, but they're quote tweeting each other. I'm like, this is a mess.
Impossible.
Write an essay, put it in a publication. I'll just read it there, you know?
Yeah, check it out on complex.com later.
Yeah, long form, please. So wait, when did you do your first album? It should be my question.
My first album came out in 2010. I think I had recorded it. I think I was done recording in 08 though, but it didn't come out till 2010.
Why the delay? Were you nervous or?
Nah, it was just my initial interactions with record labels. And like, I turned it in and then they just like stopped answering my emails for like 6 months.
No.
I remember I was so mentally scarred. Is every record label like this?
Yeah.
Like they said they want me and they gave me money to make a thing. And then when I give it to them, they won't talk to me anymore. and then just like one day out of the blue, they were like, okay, well, we got it. We're going to put a release date on it. And I'm like, what the fuck? What was that?
They're like, hey, sorry, just got this.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. The delay was record labels, record labeling. And it was a tough lesson to learn.
Was it really nerve wracking putting out your first album?
Yeah, because I didn't know how to set my expectations at all. Yeah. I had nothing to base it off of. I remember when I signed the deal, I was still working a day job. I was a teacher at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember like the day after I signed a deal, I was walking around at school in my head like, ooh, I just can't wait. These motherfuckers don't even know. I'm about to be a star. I'm like, really in my head?
Yeah.
Up and down. Like I don't really, and the album, it came out and it just kind of like came and went because I didn't understand PR at the time.
Yeah.
I didn't understand where that label was in terms of credibility or like market share in terms of how people thought about it. And this was 2010. This is before Spotify, you know,
yeah.
This is before streaming was a thing. So everything was physical. So CDs and records and iTunes. You know, and the labels were trying to figure out how to even continue. They didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah, it is so weird how things are changing still so quickly that it's hard to keep up and learn the new digital languages. It's really tough.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, when you're an independent artist, I feel like it's even more perilous in some ways because you don't have a team of experts around you to help you like navigate. I feel like being an independent artist, it's probably a lot more akin to what it is to be like a stand up or a writer where it's just, you know, it's like it's maybe you and a manager or you and an agent and y'all are just trying to like figure out what to do. You know?
Yeah. Where were you teaching or what were you teaching at the time?
The last job I had, I was teaching special ed to third and fourth graders at a non-public school here in LA. And a non-public school is a school you can only get into as a student if you've gotten kicked out of two normal public schools already. So these were very nice and well-behaved children
So you're like, I don't need you. I'm dropping an album. And then it comes out and like 3 months later, they're like, you ain't shit.
Well, I didn't tell them. They would have, Oh my God. The roasting them kids would
No one will roast you like a child. No. Oh, one.
these kids, these were like adult level roasters. Like, these were kids you could tell, like when they were at home on the block, they had to hang with older felons. So like they, you know, they didn't mince words.
Your first album, did that launch you out of that job then, or did it take a little while to get some traction? Well,
the thing was, I put it out. No, it came out in 2010. But I had gotten laid off right before it came out. So I got laid off in 2009. And that ended up, you know, launching me in a way, because that's when I was able to do my first tour. I wasn't able to tour before that because I had a day job. Like, so I could only do out of town stuff on the weekends or in the summer. And that's actually like the worst time to try to tour for indie rap. And so suddenly I was available to do like a substantial tour run. And that did, in a lot of ways, kind of kick my career off, was the availability to go on that first tour run. And I wasn't like booked on it necessarily. Like, I knew the people, the headliners.
Yeah.
And I had a relationship with them. And I was like, yo, just can I have a set every night? I'll drive myself. I'm not asking for any money. I'll just like sell CDs at the merch booth, and that'll, you know, like that'll be my take. And, you know, so I'm figuring like if I do a good job and I sell CDs, then I'm okay. And I was like basically selling enough CDs every night to like split a hotel room with a guy and have gas to drive to the next spot. And so I started from LA and I followed the tour all the way to Chicago. And then I drove back to LA.
You're from Chicago originally, right? Where about?
South Side, all over the South Side.
And what made you get into music?
I had just been around music all of my life. And then, you know, when I was in high school, I found like the South Side B-boy community. So like people who would freestyle and break dance and do graffiti and DJ, like I found that community. And I was just compelled to like do all of that stuff. So, you know, I started rapping and I kind of picked it up pretty easily. And yeah, so the music was always like a part of my life. The music itself, like consuming it, listening to it, was very important to me. And when I was in college, I started dabbling with trying to actually like put songs together.
Was there somebody in your life that made you feel like this was something you could do, that like pushed you into it?
Not necessarily that pushed me, but when I found that community in Chicago, there's this guy there who was embedded in that community. His name was Rhymefest. He actually went on to like win a Grammy writing with Kanye.
Oh, wow.
Like he wrote the song Jesus Walks.
But he didn't write the scoopity poop line.
No,
right?
I don't think anybody wrote that. I don't think that was writing. I think that was like the ghost of Louis Armstrong or something. I don't know what that was.
I can't get over that one.
you shouldn't. No one should. Because it's really bad. And it's really like available, like you can go on Spotify right now and listen to the real life recording of him saying scoopity poop, scoopity whoop, scoop. But did you hear that was low-key a petty move?
No, I didn't.
Oh, get ready for this.
Okay
So you know Kanye and Drake have a long-running beef. When at one point when they were kind of cool, Kanye had sent Drake some beats. Drake had picked a beat and started to mess with it. And he told Kanye he was going to do a song over that beat. And the next time he heard that beat, it was Kanye saying scoop diddy poop, scoop diddy whoop over the beat that Drake said he was going to use. So there's talk that was done just
that's
to
funny,
sure
just Drake to burn it. That's great.
Yep.
If that's true, I think he should get a Grammy for that level of pettiness.
Yes. That's Grammy level petty. You're right.
So that's good.
Level. That's world class.
So petty. Good. So I'm sorry. So there's this guy in Chicago.
Rhymefest. Yeah. So he, you know, when we used to rap in cyphers. We used to get, you know, just get in circles and freestyle. Like he'd be right there with us. But he also, when we went to the places where we would buy music, cassettes and CDs, you know, with this music that we loved on it, he had an album there. You know, so like he made it seem attainable just by his presence. Like, oh, this isn't like some faraway thing with people on another planet, dude. This guy that's around us in this scene has an active career. And it just kind of opened my mind up to like the possibilities of that.
Yeah. At what point did you move to L.A.? Were you
2004?
And was that, did you come straight out here from Chicago? Or here, no. I'm in Indiana right now, to to Los Angeles.
I came straight from my college town. Like, I graduated from that school, SIU in Carbondale, mm-hmm. Southern Illinois.
Okay.
And I did a year of grad school. And then like after that year, like that summer, I just like, I did the weirdest thing. I filled out financial aid to do another year of grad school.
Mm-hmm.
I got the refund check.
All right.
And I bought a car and left and drove to LA. And I just, yeah, I just learned how to drive like that year.
Oh, get out. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I guess if you're in the city.
Yeah, I never had to know how to drive. And then,
did you know anyone in LA going out?
My dad lived out here.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
He had always lived out here. So that was like the one kind of like, you know, the one person I knew here that made me feel like, oh, I could be there. You know, because if everything goes to shit, I still have my dad, you know?
Yeah, that's good. It's a nice anchor to have when you come to L.A. It's Was it hard to break in the scene out there or
in L.A.?
Yeah.
Not the way I did it, because I did it the underground way. Like I was very aware of the underground scene here in L.A. because mm-hmm. I had come out here many times visiting my dad throughout my life. And by the time I started rapping, I knew where you go to rap here in L.A.
Awesome.
So like I would always come visit, and I and some people even like remembered me when I came back and like moved. But then once I moved here, like they couldn't get rid of me. They couldn't be like, I was just there, like the mm-hmm. first guy there. Like it was every Thursday was when we had our open mic, and I would be mm-hmm. there from the beginning to the end. And I even ended up like hosting it at some point. I just completely embedded myself in it. And that's like, I called it my rap graduate school
mm-hmm.
because there were a lot of people there who had full blown indie careers, and similar to how Rhymefest was like a role model for me and showing me that you can do this. There were a lot of people around here who are doing it the same, but then on an even more functional level, because these were guys who mm-hmm. were touring, putting out albums, getting deals, you know, and it was one degree removed from me, and I could talk to them about how they did it.
Yeah, it's so crucial. I think mm-hmm. that, you know, I feel like everybody from where I grew up in the Midwest tends to do the exact same thing their parents did for a living, because they're just like, well, that's an option, I mm-hmm. guess. And they like, don't think outside of the box. So it is so crucial to see people, you know, doing what you're doing. So like after you kind of got into the scene in LA, like how did you get into the comedy scene from that? I mean, not that music's not the antithesis to comedy. I think a lot of people think of you in the comedy space.
Yeah, for sure.
Firstly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's weird. But okay, so I have to start with like just as a kid, right? Like I'm a latchkey kid mm-hmm. on the South Side, where I'm spending a lot of time at home by myself. Like my grandparents are working and I'm just watching like cable TV.
Mm-hmm.
And so comedy had been like a big part of my life. Like I feel like comedy in some ways informs how I think, even though like that's not what I do. My mind, even in terms of how I write songs, like it's very observational. It's very much about like observing what we do, drawing inferences from it, sometimes mm-hmm. adding absurdity. And then like I take those premises and make songs out of them rather than make jokes. But I feel like it's the same engine in a lot of ways. So that's always been with me. I'm in college as a fan of comedy, and at one point I become an RA, mostly just for the free housing.
All right.
Yeah.
Fair.
Yeah, it was great. smoking weed in my residence. I was the worst RA ever. One of my residents is Hannibal.
Oh.
Yeah. So like I'm his RA the week he starts doing comedy, like when he's like, I'm going to try this. Oh, that's mm-hmm. dope. And I actually showed him a lot of like comedy that he wasn't even aware of at the time. Like
uh-huh.
I showed him like Mitch Hedberg, and you know, it's like that,
yeah.
Cause I was listening to that stuff constantly. So like, I don't know, just with him and being his friend and watching his career grow over the years,
mm-hmm.
That was always in some ways like a connection to their world. But when I came out here in LA, I didn't have any intentions of embedding myself in the comedy world mm-hmm. the way I did the rap world. The thing about the rap world out here, though, especially in the underground, it was not the way to grow a fan base. Because typically when you did shows out here for that group of people, you were rapping for rappers, and it'd be a bunch of people in the room with their arms folded, looking at you, waiting for you to be done.
That sounds terrifying.
Yeah, it sucked. Sucked.
Like as bad as a comedy open mic is, that sounds so scary.
Yeah, it was a rough environment, and it was a rough environment to grow in as an artist, mm-hmm. because the kind of shows we were doing, they didn't attract a lot of casual fans, you know? Okay. Like, you know, people go to a comedy show and they have no idea who's on. Like they'll just go because they want to laugh. Like nobody goes to a rap show, they don't know anybody. That's weird, you know? Like nobody just wants to hear random people rap.
Okay, is it weird? Because I was going to do that when I get back to LA.
You're going to just go to a random rap show?
Why not?
Okay, yeah. Please record that experience because I want to hear how awesome it goes, okay?
I just want to see somebody else be tortured at some sort of open mic.
I don't even know if there are any hip hop open mics left out here, honestly. But, you know, it's those things existing was based on this faulty proposition that there were always going to be enough people interested in rap as a craft to just do that. And I think that time has kind of come and gone in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But one thing that I saw that was very interesting, there was one time I saw a rapper be the monologist at an ASCAT show at UCB.
Oh.
So he did his songs and the improvisers asked him a few questions about what the song's about. And then they start doing sketches based mm-hmm. off of his music. And I was like, I gotta fucking do that. And I did. And it went great in so many ways. For me, the sorts of reactions that I got from the audience mm-hmm. were like, they would laugh at the part of the verse that I thought was funny. Like okay. they were actually listening to what I was saying.
Uh-huh.
It was like mind blowing for me because I was so used to rapping for people who didn't really care.
Oh, more so for people that are like listening for it musically.
Yeah. And like paying attention to like the concepts of the song and the punchlines that I'm putting in the verses.
Got
and
it.
Following along and reacting. That was really huge for me. Like that like lit something up in me. I'm like, oh, wait, there are people who will listen to what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. So in that way, it was great because it made me want to keep performing for comedy crowds.
Yeah.
And then the improvisers on that show also saw how great that was going. And all of them had shows at UCB throughout the week and the month. Mm-hmm. And they would bring me back to be the musical guest on their shows.
Oh, that's so fun.
Yeah, so this is like Matt Besser. Gosh, there's this other guy. He's so damn good. He was in that comedy group with DC Pearson and Donald Glover. Oh gosh,
I'm not going to remember.
They're so good. They had this movie that's incredible, and he used to make all of these like sketches and stuff. But he's another. He had me on his stuff, and so like it. And the second time I did it, I made sure I had it video recorded mm-hmm. so that I could use that footage to try to get myself booked on other comedy shows.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So like that's how I ended up doing Paul F. Tompkins' show at Largo. Mm-hmm. And that was probably like a big game changing show, I think.
Really?
Him putting me on his shows. So like this is a bigger audience, you know, in Largo. And in not like he's doing like a variety show. So he's introducing me to musicians and standups and improvisers and actors. And it's just it really became an access point to this whole different world. I seem to belong to, even though I was new to it. It made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And so like there's a lot of people to this day that I met doing those shows that I still keep in touch with and work with and have relationships with.
That's so cool. It feels like music is always welcome in comedy, but I don't know if there was a lineup of a bunch of rappers, I don't think you could just throw a comic on and be like, special guest.
I've done something like that. I used to do variety shows in town.
Really?
Yeah. But I saw it not go well a couple times.
Yeah.
And so then I learned that I could only book comics who really understood how to do that.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't do your normal act.
Of course, yeah.
Because like, you know, if there's music throughout the show, there's a segment of people at the show who feel like they don't have to be quiet because during, like they're ordering drinks or they're talking right. to the person next to them, like, because there's noise for most of the show where it doesn't matter. So like, you have to be the kind of comic where you're either going to stop that from happening or you're not going to let it bother you and you're just going to speak to the people who are listening. You know, it's not an easy environment.
Totally. I feel like also music, people that are at a show to hear music, they're there to like tap into a mood. So if you interrupt that mood, they're like, what the fuck are you doing?
That's true. It is a different kind of listening experience, I think. I think that's really valid. Like you're there to have a good time and zone and maybe move around. Mm-hmm. You're not necessarily there to listen to what someone has to say.
Yeah, which is a completely different thing.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Are there things from doing the shows at Largo that you've gotten that you can trace back to those shows at Largo?
I mean, I have a relationship with Largo from those shows, which
that's awesome.
To me feels like invaluable.
You know, that's what I'm saying? Huge.
Like,
yeah.
And I haven't like used it yet, but like just even having that sort of recognition and welcoming and like phone number, like feels mm-hmm. like a good thing. Did I ever do anything there on my own? I haven't, but I've just performed there a lot with a lot of different people. Like, you know, like those Thrilling Adventure Hour people.
Yeah.
Like that whole network of folks.
Yeah.
Like I've done so much stuff with them. And it all traces back to like those original Largo shows that I did with Paul F. Tompkins.
That's so cool. And that's like one of very few places in LA that industry people will actually go out. So if you're trying to like make some moves in that space, that's a really great place to have access to, you know, whenever we're back to real life again in 2024.
Yeah.
Hopefully sooner. Is there something like looking back on your life and career, is there something that like seemed like it was going to be terrible at the time or seemed maybe even insignificant that changed your life for the better?
So I have this podcast network and I have this flagship show called What Had Happened Was. And in the first season of it, I interviewed DJ and producer Prince Paul every week. And so we're talking about all of the albums and projects that he produced. So this is like De La Soul, Handsome Boy Modeling School. He's like, he produced albums for Chris Rock. This long storied career. And the response to this podcast has been like really, really dope. And I was really sensitive to that because the idea started as something that I was shopping with a bigger podcast network.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, after we did the pilot, which I thought was great, they were like, oh, we don't know what to do with this. And so, like, I'm like, oh, you know, kind of crestfallen thinking that this idea is not good. But I ended up putting it out under my own umbrella.
And that's great.
A lot of people really, really, really love it. But that's not the original. The original thing that felt disappointing, the original thing that I felt like was bad, the way that I met Prince Paul is I was called in to do a couple of songs on this project that he was producing.
Okay.
And this guy is like a hero of mine. And he's made some of the music just been most impactful to me in my life. So like, I was really excited about this opportunity to be able to work with him. So they sent me a couple of the beats and I do a couple demos and they didn't like them. like one of those things where I was like, I sent them off all excitedly. And then the email back was like, let's come up with a time to get on the phone. I'm like, oh,
no, that's the worst.
That's not effusive praise at all. It's not what I
you're like, oh, you have the wrong email address. I'm sorry.
And you know, they got on the phone and told me they weren't necessarily feeling them. And they, you know, and.
No, and wait, I'd almost rather somebody just email me that than talk to them live.
I feel that, but I actually appreciated it because they were able to lay out how it wasn't that they just thought they were completely terrible. It just wasn't the approach that they were looking for.
Got it.
And I was, you know, that I was really down about that. I thought like, oh shit, here I had the shot to like work with one of my heroes and I blew it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But from that meeting and working with him, I was able to build this idea of doing this podcast.
Yeah.
Which ended up being very successful. So like, even though that felt terrible at the time, like,
<Yeah.
laughs> you know, having put my creative energy into those songs and for them not to really be feeling them. But I think I managed to turn that, like the fact that I had that relationship.
Yeah.
I managed to turn that into something that like went really well.
That's great. Well, and I think it's, you know, one of the marks of somebody who is good at their craft yourself, when you can take notes and you can adjust what you're doing, rather than like, I think some people get a no, or they get, somebody says like, oh, this isn't quite right. And then they just like lose their minds and they're like, right. Well, no, I'm a fucking genius. And it's like, yeah. Well, okay. sure. You are.
You know, and it's easy to have that, like, especially in the space that I'm in, because I typically don't have to answer to anybody. Like,
yeah,
if I'm dealing with a record label, it's usually a record label with like two employees tops, and they, mm-hmm. they sign me because they like what I do, and I give it to them and they put it out. There's typically not a lot of oversight.
Right.
So you can come out of that with this feeling like, yeah, whatever I want to do is good. You know, it's fine. It'll go great. So it can be difficult to hear that, like, you need to take a different approach, but that was actually a lesson I learned doing TV stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To like readjust.
To take my ego out of it. Mm. Because when you're in that TV world and all the network execs have a say, and there's so many producers, and like, it's such a high stakes, like, creativity by committee.
Yeah.
That you have to learn, how to take feedback. And,
absolutely.
And adjustments.
I feel like it in TV. I love it so much. I love writing for TV. You know, if anybody wants to hire me again, I'd like a job. but it is crazy where you're like, we're getting notes from who? Do they even work here? What's going on? You know, there's like somehow 300 people, and then they're like, well, let me call my grandma and make sure she likes it too. And I'm like, hold on, stop this. You know. Yes.
It can get out of hand quickly.
It is crazy. And I think that, you know, I think that oftentimes creative people complain about it being prohibitive, but sometimes it can form something. It can just polish something up to get it to a mm-hmm. really great place where you're like, and it can be frustrating too, when you're like, I did this thing and I think it's good and it's ready to go. And people want to keep adjusting it until it's like their version of perfect or whatever. But it's fun.
It is. And you know, as an artist with developing maturity, I had to learn about refinement.
Yeah.
And learn that sometimes it's good to write the verse over. Sometimes it's good to re-record the verse. Sometimes it's good to go in and change the words around. And the other side of that is sometimes you do lose something in that initial energy. You know, when like that moment, sometimes you can't recapture that moment in the refinement, but typically it is better to work to make things better.
Yes. And
that's a lesson it took me a long time to learn.
It is hard. When I first started comedy, I thought talent was finite. And I thought, well, this is so great. I can't touch it because this is as good as my ideas are ever going to get, which is a cuckoo thing to think.
This is peak Lisa, you know?
God forbid. Like, do you ever look back on old songs and just kind of wince a little bit? Like, what the fuck?
My first album.
Really?
It's tough.
Really?
I was doing this thing where I wrote the whole thing in these kind of like four bar sections where like every bar had to have the exact same like rhyme structure. This is really technical, but if anybody out here, if you go listen to this album, like the thing that you think is annoying, it's that. It's like I was so on the grid about the rhyming and how like every four bars had to rhyme exactly, like five syllables. They had to all rhyme perfectly. And it used to sound like a damn robot.
You know, were you trying to be like good in a technical sense rather than in an artistic sense?
Oh my God. There was no emotion.
Yeah.
It was like reading raps off the paper. You know what I'm saying? It's not good. It's not, I mean, you know, and I have to say that for who I was as a person, I was aiming high and I had good ideas. I just had no idea how to like record. I didn't know how to record. Like, I grew up rapping on street corners, and that's a whole different way of like doing your mouth than trying to like rap into a microphone, you know?
Yeah. I think that there is this thing about artists that are new to their craft where you're like, I'm going to do something no one's ever done. And it's like, no, there's a reason no one's been doing that.
Yeah. You know? That's true.
You know, it is funny. Like, I think that you should be like, sometimes when people come up with these like rigid parameters to work within, it doesn't work. Like, I don't like some people that try to put out an album every year. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you might not have the inspiration all year. Like, don't
might not be there.
Yeah. Don't limit yourself to that, or don't, or maybe don't say it publicly at least, right, so that you don't have to then follow through on it, you know?
Yeah. Because then, I mean, you know, the other side of that too, is you're not necessarily giving anything a chance to take hold.
Yeah.
You know, and break out and possibly be bigger if you're already on to the next thing, you know?
Right. Well, and you don't want to put parameters on a project that would hinder your emotions in the project. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense. Like, I think you have to be true to your emotional self first and not the business side of it first. Mm-hmm. If that even makes sense.
Well, I mean, I do. Yeah. I see both of those. Like, you have to be aware of where you are as a person, and what you're dealing with, and how much you're trying to process through the craft. And you have to be aware of like what your audience is doing and how things reach them, and whether or not they'll be hungry for more, whether or not they'll be burned out. Like, you do have to think about all those things. And I do think it's great to always be making stuff. I don't think it's great to always be putting stuff out.
Yeah. Yes. That's what Tweet Drafts are for me.
It's 100%. My drafts are the gnarliest place in the world.
I write a lot of stuff when I'm high, and then the next day I'm like, oh no.
Yeah.
No.
My high tweets are like, I just love how I'll go there sometimes.
Yeah.
I love how I'll just get into this little minuscule crevice of an idea and like really try to build a home there.
Yeah.
I do appreciate that about myself. And I try to bring that into my sober life.
Yeah. You know? That's funny. It can be a lot of fun. What do you think? I mean, are you going to be working in TV more now that you've done it and it's worked out?
Well, you know, man, worked out is a relative term, man. I had two TV shows that both lasted one season. You know,
I think that's excellent. I've had zero TV shows. So.
I noticed that there's a difference in my representation and their energy level, like that. So that whole sort of thing. And it's like, on the one hand, I'm like definitely trying to cook up more projects because I know I'm not always going to have these relationships. So I want to take advantage of them while I do. In another sense though, it's like, I don't know what to do. And I've experienced definitely some success, but a ton of rejection. And I'm not really built for that. Like, I talk to Baron Vaughn about this all the time, because like, he's an actor, and just being an actor is like a constant state of living with rejection, because you audition for 10 things and get one, you know. But I come from independent rap where I don't have to answer to anybody and I can do what I want. Like, I hate the auditioning mindset where like, I'm supposed to put my best into something. First of all, you're not even going to tell me about it till 2 days ahead of it.
No matter what
else I got to do.
Absolutely.
I can bring my absolute best self to it. And if they don't want me, they're not even going to tell me why.
Yeah.
You don't even get any feedback. Like, that to me is like, that's like stealing from my soul.
Yeah. You're just in a room and there's like casting people in the shadows. You can't even see their face.
Oh my God. And like, you know, it would be completely different if they would send you a note to say, we liked it, but, or we felt like it needed this. They don't care.
They don't care at all. And it could be, it's always like, there could be something really confounding too. Like, I don't know. She reminds me of my niece, and my niece is a bitch, you know? And it's like, what? Oh, what does it have to do with anything? It's so funny because I kind of went the opposite way, where I initially came out to LA for acting. And then I was like, this is crazy. I don't have control over anything. I can't do this.
Yes.
And like, you know, it's just, it is the lack of control and like the zero feedback. And it's so frustrating to go through the rejection over and over again. And you're like, I can't even, there's nothing I can do. I just have to come back next week and hear no again.
Right. Okay. You got to figure out how to get hot.
Like, okay.
What? Like, you know, like I, there was a time in 2018 or is it 19? 2019, mm-hmm. Where I lived at the time, I could look out of my bedroom window and see a billboard with my face on it.
Oh, that's incredible.
I still couldn't get nothing, though. Like, it's got to be the hottest. It's like the hottest you can be. I get nothing. I got told no that month.
I'm just picturing you like on the phone trying to order something or get through to someone and pacing around your apartment and looking out the window and being like, God damn it.
Yes.
Just.
Oh, it's so like, you know, as much as I want, I would love to do more stuff, and I'm working on more stuff. I'm trying to figure out how to do it in a way where it's not so soul crushing, because I feel like for me, like just where my sensitivities lie, it's a really rough environment for me.
Yeah. It's hard, especially, are you someone that like lets yourself get excited about opportunities?
I used to. Now I know better. Now I'm like, you know what I get excited about?
What's that?
When the check hits my account, that's when I get excited. Like anything, like nothing else. Like nothing else. Like I don't get excited about potential.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there's no hope.
Yeah.
Nothing.
And then
my account.
Yeah. And then you get an email and they're like, ooh, sorry. We sent that to the wrong account.
Oh, you can't get it back.
I'm running away.
No, I'm withdrawing everything and I'm leaving right now.
That's so funny. I still get so excited, which, I mean, about anything. I can have like a phone call set up and I'm like, oh my God, this is going to change everything. And then like, I go to this place in my mind where I could set up a phone call with somebody, this weekend, say, I would spend the entire weekend daydreaming about what this could lead to and like how much money I'll make from this opportunity. Mm-hmm. And like, like the house I'll buy with that money. And I'm like, oh, and then I like kind of snap out of it. And I'm like, oh, I'm sitting at my cousin's house because I haven't worked in over a year. And
Lisa, I have learned. I have truly learned. Like I used to fantasize about game changers. Now I try to tell myself every day that there's no such thing. There might be game changers for other people. There will not be game changers for me. Everything is a drop in the bucket. And maybe one day the bucket becomes too full and something happens. I don't know. Maybe I die. I don't know. But like, I can't focus on the idea of like a thing happening that changes everything. Cause I've seen so many good things happen and do nothing. You know, I've seen that happen too many times. And like, and it's to the point now where I'm a bit jaded. I'm a bit cynical. Like, you know, I'll have a call with somebody where like they are basically telling me they want me for something, and I'm talking to them about it, or I'm doing a read for it, or having an interview, but whatever it is. And like, I try my best to forget about it as soon as I hit end on that conversation.
Because, oh man,
like, I don't want to be living in the fantasy of what if, what if, what if, what if.
Yeah. It's so hard not to, though, because it is so fun. I get really sucked into it. And I feel like also, I think for me, if I'm not fantasizing about what could happen, then I go to a very dark place. There isn't like a middle zone where I'm like, I feel good. I'm making a living. I can take care of myself. It's like either I'm going to be rich in a couple of months or I should kill myself. Not like I should kill myself, but you know what I mean? Like,
I know what you mean. Either it's all about to go great or it's all about to go to shit. You know, like I totally understand the feeling, but you know, I say this a lot and I don't practice it enough. I'm trying to get better about like having gratitude. You know, I'm trying to get better about that, because I do feel like that's kind of what's missing from my brain processes, is like really taking the time and like soaking up the when good things happen and sitting with it and being like, damn, that was something good that happened. You know, because there's, I feel like with every good thing that I can isolate, there's acute pain associated with it. It's so hard not to feel it all.
It is also interesting, back to like, I mean, you were saying this earlier, like when you think something is going to change, when you do something that you think is huge and then it doesn't move the needle, it's like, what happened? Or the disparity between what the industry finds impressive and what you're proud of yourself for is, it's never the same thing. It's, you know, it,
Wow.
Or at least for me, like I worked on Jim Jefferies' show, which was a lot of fun, but I feel that maybe because it's attached to Jim and Jim's a celebrity, like so many people are impressed by that. And I'm like, yeah, but I did this big tour on my own. And they're like, yeah, whatever. And I'm like, do you know which one was harder?
Wow. I do find, for me, it's hard to know what's going to translate as a bigger deal to the industry. But also, I feel like I don't interface with the industry enough. Like, I feel like I only interface with the industry like through my own representation.
Okay.
But so then I just have no idea what sense anyone in the industry has of me.
Oh, it's like, bad. It's really bad.
Move from it. Yeah.
They Not told bad. Me. Yeah.
Oh, good. I'd like to see all of your memos, please. Thank you. Forward them over.
Yeah, I meant to. I think they meant to email you. It's all just, hey, we gotta talk.
Well, I got the check that went to you, and you got the memo perfect. That was meant for me. I'm cool with that arrangement. We can just keep it that way.
Perfect. Yeah, that sounds good. I like. I recently hired an assistant, and I just part time take care of some things for me. And I forwarded so many email things to her that I'm like, you just tell me what the vibe of it is.
The vibe. Oh, you got a professional vibe checker. That's tight.
I'm like, I don't want to read it. So just like, tell me.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
So I could, maybe ease my way into rejection. Maybe that's the key. Maybe you have somebody else read things and take on news and synthesize it. So they go through the emotional roller coaster and then they just give you, whatever residual.
I want an assistant. I don't know how you pay an assistant. I don't know. I don't know how you come up. I don't know what the rate is. I don't get it.
Oh, well, we could talk about that.
Okay. Well, yeah.
I mean, after this. Yeah.
Yeah. Put me on.
if your childhood self could see you now, like, what do you think you as a little kid would think of you?
I think because I've done a pro wrestling match.
Excuse me?
I did a pro wrestling match.
Wait, like you emceed it or like?
No.
Hold on a second.
I was in a match and I won.
What? How do I not know this about you?
Oh man, I don't know. I did. I put it out. See, that's the thing. I put
you
it
gotta
out.
Put up a billboard.
But like just that alone, like that thing, mm-hmm. like my child self would be like over the moon. If I like, you know what I'm saying? Like
just the wrestling match. Yeah.
Done that. Yeah. Like, and like Mick Foley was in it. Like it was a big deal.
What?
Yeah.
Wait, this, who did you wrestle?
This guy, Shiloh Jones. I'll send sure. it to you.
Okay.
I'll send it to you. But like,
was that, this part of the underground rap scene too? They just pulled you into the ring.
this was a whole other thing that happened. It was glorious. It was glorious. There was rap involved, though. There was rap involved.
Okay, good.
But, having done a wrestling match, having been on TV, like specifically on Comedy Central, having been on like Adult Swim, having I've been on songs with like MF Doom, having a relationship with Prince Paul. And like I do so many things that like my child self would be like over the moon about, just mind mm-hmm. blown, I think in that sense, like my child self would see me as like some fucking superhero, except for my pot belly. My child self would be
oh my goodness,
very disappointed with the current shape of my body. Extremely disappointed. Me and my child self, mm-hmm. we used to do sit-ups and push-ups every day.
Oh, wow.
Even as a young person, because we wanted to look like the wrestlers.
Okay.
So this
All right,
would
that's
be
fair.
A gigantic.
Is that what you thought you wanted to do when you were a kid or like thought?
No, I never thought I could, because I never thought I'd be big enough to actually do it, so it was just always like a daydream, like a fantasy, but I just always loved wrestling, like deeply.
Oh, wow. My older brothers never got into it. So I kind of never knew anything about it. I mean, I like knew who Hulk Hogan was, and that was 100% of my wrestling knowledge. And now is like 50% of it.
Yeah. No, it's gotten really, that world has become just as like indie and weird and alt as every other world, but I just, there's things I appreciate about that, 'cause it's such a unique brand of entertainment, everybody's bought in, and like, there's no off season, and
it's fucking tough.
It's super tough. It's, yeah. I hurt myself training, like, you know,
get out.
Yeah, for one match. Like,
so this was like a, you worked up to this. How far out was it planned?
Couple months.
Okay. All right. So longer than an audition.
Yeah, yes. For sure. Yeah. For sure. They definitely have more respect for you as a wrestler than they have for you as an actor. For sure.
Yeah, people have more respect for you if you're a serial killer than an actor. At least they get documentaries.
That's true. That's true. They get fan clubs, you know?
Yeah. They get all kinds of stuff. A whole series. A Netflix deal. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate you being here and taking your time. That was a lot of fun. And what's the name of your album again? I don't know it offhand.
It's Anime, Trauma, and Divorce is the name of the album.
Yeah. Check it out.
Yeah, please do.
All right. Thanks. See ya.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. Once again, that was Open Mike Eagle. You can find him on Twitter at @Mike_Eagle and on Instagram at @Open_Mike_Eagle. I'm Lisa Curry. You can find me on Twitter at @Lisa_Curry. Apparently, we really love underscores here. And you can find me on Instagram at @OlympianLisaCurry. That's it. Make sure to tune in next week for one more episode of Long Story Long before I move over to iTunes on the 18th. And have a great weekend, everyone. Bye.